for sure. I'm Michael Pascoe and this is Timothy. We're from a company called Olica, and we are experts in systems management for the enterprise across the desktop, mobility, data center and cloud. And today we are talking about migrating from VMware to Hyper-V, right? Before we get into it, I just want to suggest something to you. Sorry, I didn't quite mean to sound weird or dodgy about that. How are you doing? Migrate does not equal convert. You're probably thinking migration equals converting machines over, and I just want to challenge that thinking a little bit in this session. Really, what is your goal? What are we trying to achieve here? What's the goal? And that's what we need to stay focused on. We're really just trying to move workloads from VMware to Hyper-V. So, you know, there's the obvious way of doing that. The pick it up, move it over, and plonk it down, and then you've done the migration, right? The convert and relocate. But there is also another way to just think about in the back of your minds, which is the, you know, move the contents out of one place and stick the contents into another place. Maybe move the files and the data out of one server and stick it into a nice shiny new server somewhere else on Hyper-V. So we'll talk a little bit more about how that fits into part of your migration strategy a little later. Overall, what's the migration process? You know, we think there's kind of four steps to this. One is to build a Hyper-V environment. If you're going to migrate to it, I suppose you need to have one. The second is to identify exactly what you've got in VMware and plan how you're going to get those things over. Map them out, put them in groups, kind of work out a migration strategy for which machines are coming and which ones aren't and in which way. The third is to do the actual migration, right? So we kind of see the identify and map and the migration as a bit hand in hand. In reality, you might do a bit of identifying and mapping, you know, and then you start into your migration, and then you do a bit more identifying and mapping it out, and then do the next stage of the migration, and they kind of continue hand in hand for a little while. And then the optimize and automate. And this might be something that you do through the process of migration. If you've got a large environment, you're probably looking to optimize the migration process. But also after you finish migrating, when you're on the new platform, looking at what advantages you can get by Hyper-V and take it to the next level. But before we get into that, I want to ask you, what on earth are you doing? Why are you doing this? Why are you going to Hyper-V? And that's a question that you need to be clear about in your mind before you start this process. Why are you doing it? Is it maybe because, you know, you want to try it out? You have read a lot about it, you've seen some blog posts, you've come to some sessions at TechEd, and you're thinking, yeah, all right, yeah, I'm ready to try. But I want to see it in my environment. I want it with my network. I want to see and touch and feel it before I'm kind of sure to go forward. So I've kind of got a limited scope for that migration. Or maybe you have a project that you feel is kind of the right fit for it. Maybe it's a new hardware project or something like that. You're getting a whole bunch of new kit. Maybe you're getting some, you know, new storage or something. Maybe, you know, something fast and high performance, low cost, like a nimble storage or something like that for a VDI project. And you're thinking, well, this is a good opportunity to go new project, new kit, new hypervisor. And so I'll do it for that. Or maybe you're a bit past that and you're thinking, you're like, yeah, I'm serious, I'm convinced. I'm going to do it for my whole network. I'm going to move all my workloads over to Hyper-V, in which case, you know, your scope of the project that you're doing here will be a little bit different than some of those other reasons. And you might also be using that kind of opportunity to think about re-architecting other pieces of your network, like building better high availability in or changing the way that you do DR or maybe even, again, changing some hardware. So those kinds of things fall into the project there and really change the scope of the migration to Hyper-V. Or maybe you are just being told by your boss to do it, to get off Hyper-V, get off VMware, because he doesn't want to pay anymore, and move across. And you kind of like your job more than you like VMware, so you're going to do that. But once you kind of know why you're doing this, it's time to look at the four steps that we think that you should be doing. So the first is building your Hyper-V environment. So this is really where you're laying down the foundation, the infrastructure for your new virtualization environment. The first step, design. Probably not that surprising, probably not something that everyone always does, but do a design. Now keep that design in line with the scope of what you're achieving, what you're trying to set out to achieve here. If you're only doing it, I'm trying it out, I just want to see it in my environment. I mean, maybe that's not a proof of concept. That could well be a production implementation, but still a limited production implementation. So obviously the design you do for that is going to be simpler than the design you do for a whole environment implementation, right? So do a design, think about Hyper-V, think about how you're going to architect it, and think about VMM as well. And we think that the next step is not to actually go and build Hyper-V, but instead to go and build VMM. And a lot of people kind of do this the other way around. You can do it the other way around. It doesn't kind of cause any permanent serious problem. But if VMM is going to be the tool you're using to manage Hyper-V, then maybe stick that tool in so that when you have Hyper-V, you can manage it straight away. And when you're thinking about the VMM installation, you've got to think, where is it going to run? So it should be virtual. There's no reason that VMM should be running on a physical machine. And where will that virtual VMM machine run? Well, at this point in time, you don't have Hyper-V. So stick it where you put your other virtual workloads today, on VMware, right? Install it, fresh install, put it on VMware, and then get in and start to, you know, configure a little bit of VMM before you even build Hyper-V. Now, it's not going to be a long delay, but we still think it should be first. And when you're doing the VMM installation, you just need to think about a couple of little things. VMM by itself, just as a standalone server, isn't highly available. I mean, you can probably put it on your VMware or Hyper-V virtualization and make it highly available so it can fail over to another host, but it does have that reboot like everything else. Or you can actually install it in a clustered mode so that you have two VMM servers and the application itself is highly available through clustering. And which choice you make there kind of depends on how important VMM is to you. If it's just a tool you're using for administration, you can probably handle it being rebooted. If you've got a VDI project kind of being used by it and the brokers are speaking to VMM to fire up virtual machines for users, then VMM is a critical part of that and really needs to always be up. It can't kind of have the reboot if a host did fail. So you may actually want to cluster the VMM install. And if you do, then you need to be putting the database onto a shared, you know, SQL database, remote SQL database. Otherwise, you can put the database for VMM locally. So get that installed and probably run it on your VMware infrastructure since that's what you have. And then you've got, at that point, VMM, and you've got VMware, and you don't have Hyper-V necessarily. So we think that it kind of makes sense to, at that point, there and then, hook it up, hook VMM up to VMware, so that you can see in VMM your VMware infrastructure and the guests. And this will become important because as you start to build Hyper-V hosts and migrate guests across, you know, at any point in time, which guests are running on VMware and which guests are running in Hyper-V will change. And so it's just, you know, one good place to see where things are today. So Timothy is actually going to run through a demo and show us how to add VMware into Hyper-V.
Cool. Okay. So here we've got just a freshly installed Virtual Machine Manager install. So no guests, no hosts, no nothing. If we go into settings down here, there's the VMM service account. So this is the account that VMM uses for all ongoing operations. If we want to get our VMware infrastructure managed, we need to give permissions to this account to our VMware infrastructure. So I'm just going to go into vCenter up here, and I'm going to add permissions at the root. And we'll give it administrator privileges. Done. That's all we need to do in vCenter. So now, if we go into the fabric view, we have add resources. You'll notice that there's actually two options here, VMware ESX hosts and clusters, and also the vCenter server. If we actually try to add an ESX host first, we can't do it, because all communication, or almost all communication, is through the vCenter server itself. So vCenter is really important. So we need to do that one first. So I'm just going to put in the FQDN. And the VMM service account. So this is the same account that we just added permissions to. And now we've got a note about secure mode. So secure mode just means instead of using credentials for our initial authentication, we're going to use certificates instead. Look, whether you have secure mode enabled or not, all communication is still over SSL. So I'm going to disable it only because, from our experience, we've seen a bit of flakiness with self-signed certificates if you have this enabled. So this is going to be dependent upon your environment. I'll just hit OK. And then the vCenter server should pop up. Any second now. There we go. So we're now able to go in and add our ESX hosts. Now, we do need an account here for VMM to talk directly to the host. This is really only used just for VMM library operations. For things like creating guests, turning them on and off, all that stuff, all communication is going to go through vCenter. I haven't joined my host here, my ESX host, to the domain, so I'm just going to put in the ESX I root account. But you can use a domain account in your environment if you wish. And that's probably a better idea, actually. All right. Cool. OK. So now we can see all the hosts that that vCenter server that we added in before is managing. In this case, it's just one. Previous versions of the product would just add everything in straight away. You didn't have that, that control. So you now have that control, so you can add in some of them, all of them. I'm going to go all one in this case. Now, we also have the option to group our hosts together. And how you choose to do this is largely up to you. You could group them by location, physical location. You could group them by hypervisor platform, like Hyper-V or ESX. I'm just going to stick with the default all hosts group there and finish. So our ESX I host has popped up straight away. But where are the guests? Well, they're still going to come in. It's just going to take a few minutes for that to happen. The reason for that is that VMM is now interrogating the server just to find out what it's got on it and all that. So we should see them pop up. While we're waiting for that, though, virtual switches, all the configuration that we've done in vCenter has come across. So I just wanted to point that out. And also, there is one thing we need to do, and that's management here. We need to retrieve and accept the certificate that's used by this host. And we'll just hit OK there. Any second now. Did you want to mention anything just while we're waiting?
I guess what I can start talking about while we just wait for those to pop through is that's connecting. So we've installed VMM, clean install. We've connected it up to our vCenter infrastructure, and then we'll be able to see shortly the hosts and the guests that are in VMware. So the next step will be to start installing Hyper-V. Now, when we are installing Hyper-V, I guess it's probably worth just talking about a design decision that you have to make there. It's not really one that requires a lot of thinking, but you probably still do need to make sure you put a little bit towards it, which is just simply, are you going to cluster it or not, right? And for some reason, we've seen a lot of companies go and install Hyper-V and not necessarily cluster them, just kind of install some standalone servers. And I just want to take the second to encourage you to make sure that you do consider clustering them. It's really simple. All you need is some shared storage, two boxes. You assign the shared storage to both hosts, and then in VMware, it's really simple just to say that these are, make a cluster and make those two hosts part of it, and then you can just make other hosts part of it later as well. So, you know, I don't know why people haven't kind of done that. Maybe it's just people standing up a VMware, a Hyper-V server on the side or something like that and just using direct attached storage. But really do take that opportunity to think about that and do it. Even if you're just doing, you know, I'm just trying it out in my environment, get two boxes, carve off a bit of storage from your existing LUN and assign it through. All right, so obviously those machines have been pulled in, those guests.
Yep, and that's all we needed to do. So just a little bit more patience.
So with installing Hyper-V, really the process is quite simple. You need to get Server 2012 onto a physical host. You need to install a role called Hyper-V onto it. And then you need to go into VMM and import that server into VMM so it knows about it. Now, how you get the server OS installed on that physical host and install the Hyper-V role is really up to you. You know, you can just manually install Server 2012 and then go into Server Manager and install the role, or you can use any kind of automated provisioning process that you already have to configure that up, or in fact, VMM actually has the ability to do bare metal provisioning where it will get the host to Pixie boot and then install Server 2012 and then install the role and join it to the domain and do some network configuration and then import it into VMM for you as well. So it can be all automated by VMM, but you don't need to do that to start with. All you need to do is get Server 2012 installed, install the Hyper-V role, and then add it to VMM. And I think Timothy actually is going to show us that right now.
Yep, absolutely. Oh,
I got it.
Seven. Cool. Okay. So here's one I prepared earlier. Okay, so I've just got a physical HP DL360, I think, server here. I've installed the drivers onto it. I've joined it to the domain, all basic stuff. Let's just have a quick look at networking. So I've got a NIC here for guest traffic and a NIC for management. The management one has got a static IP address. The guest one we don't really care so much about. So that's just using DHCP. Obviously, in a production environment, you'd probably look at things like NIC teaming and all that stuff. For this example, I haven't really bothered with that. Cool. So how did I actually get Hyper-V on here? Well, as Mike mentioned, it's just a role. So from Server Manager in here, add roles, go through the wizard, and then here we get to Hyper-V. So you just tick that, hit next. Now, if you scroll down a little bit, you see this one here called Multipath IO. If you're using shared storage, which probably most of you hopefully are, you'll need to have that one enabled as well. So just installing Hyper-V won't enable that. If you do it at the same time, you can avoid a second reboot because both things require a reboot. So just do that. And then you'd hit install. So the server will then reboot a couple of times, and you'd be running Hyper-V. Yay.
And that takes about 10 minutes or so to install.
It takes about, 10 to 12 minutes on this server, so we didn't bother showing that. Actually, if I just go back into server Manager here, we go to Hyper-V Manager, and this is what you get. This is what it gives you, nothing. So if you go into Virtual Switch Manager here, no virtual switches, no network connectivity at all. We could configure it here, but we've installed VMM, so how about we use VMM instead? Okay, so back into the Fabric view. So the same way that we added an ESX host, we do the same for a Hyper-V host. Now, this screen will give you a few options. The first option, the Windows Server Computers in a Trusted Active Directory domain, that's going to be what we're going to do, because we've just done a manual install, it's in the domain, all good. The fourth option, the physical computers to be provisioned as virtual machine hosts, that's the bare metal provisioning process that Mike just quickly mentioned before. That might be something that you look at later. It's a bit like VMware Autodeploy if anybody's using that. So it really allows you to get running really quickly and consistently. It's definitely worth looking at. Okay. So we need initial creds to connect to the host, creds which have administrator privileges on that host. I'm just going to use my domain admin account. Oops. Now, the important thing to note is that these creds are only used this one time. They're not stored in the VMM database. They're not used for ongoing operations or anything like that. Part of this process is actually these credentials will add the VMM service account to the local administrators group on that Hyper-V server. So, and that's what VMM uses for all ongoing operations. Now, if you remember our Hyper-V server before, it was just called Hyper-V. If you're installing a few manually and you know you just want to add them all in, there's an implicit wildcard here. So hype is enough to find Hyper-V 1, 2, to 8, or however many you've got. And it's just searching Active Directory here. Tick that one. Yep. So once again, just like VMware, we can put it in some groups. You know, I'm just going to leave it in there. Okay. Here's something that is different from the VMware process. Live migration and storage. So this is for simultaneous live migrations. You might be thinking, oh, what, two? But actually, it's a per host setting because, well, all this configuration is actually really dependent on how many resources your host has. It's largely network dependent. You know, two simultaneous might be enough, especially if you've got some older hosts or a slower network. Alternatively, you could just bump that up. Yeah, so you won't know until you maybe give it a shot. But even if you actually queue up like 20 or so, it's just going to like do two at a time and then go through and go through and go through. So it's not actually going to prevent you from queuing up a whole bunch. And finish. Cool. So if we just go back into jobs here, with a bit of luck, we should just go through and this should just be added. Now, if you recall earlier, we didn't have any virtual switches set up in Hyper-V Manager. We said that we'd use VMM to implement those. So that's really the last step that we need to do. Actually, I'll just go here. So virtual switches, new standard switch. Okay, now this is an external network, and both our NICs have come up. So which one is it going to be? Well, if we go to hardware here, we can actually see the labels that we've given to our NICs. So we've got the guest one here, which is available for placement, and our management one, which is used by management, but also available for placement. We don't really want our guest VMs to use this, so I'm just going to untick available for placement. And we need 51. So if we just go back to virtual switches, just make sure 51 is there. OK. Yeah, I might lose connectivity for a second. Cool. Go back here. And now we can see that we should have a virtual one appear. So we've got vEthernet now. And we can see it's a Hyper-V virtual Ethernet adapter. And if we go into virtual switch manager, it's appeared here.
So this is back on the Hyper-V server.
Sorry, yes, this is back on the Hyper-V server. Sorry, I did that a little bit quickly. So Hyper-V and VMM. That's it.
Awesome, thanks. Okay, so you've built your Hyper-V environment, right? So you've got VMM, you're managing ESX or VMware with it, you've got a Hyper-V environment, it's being managed by VMM. What next? Well, we think that you need to start to identify and map out what you've got in VMware so you can start to work out how to bring them across to Hyper-V. So really, you know, when you're looking at those VMware workloads, you need to start to consider a few other things that aren't just about bringing that machine across as it is. Now, I have a theory that because of virtualization, we're not upgrading guest OS versions as often as we used to when we had to in the physical world. Because every 3 or 4 years or whatever, we'd have to get a new physical server and go, right, I've got to get everything from this physical server onto this physical server. It's 4 years since I did it last time. There's a new OS version out, so I'm going to put the new one on and then get all the bits across onto that. But, you know, new servers come and go, they get put onto the virtualization layer, we just move some guests across onto it, and we're not touching the guests as often as we used to. So maybe a migration to a new virtualization platform could be a reason or a project where you consider whether you should upgrade the guest OSs as well. And maybe not just upgrading the OSs of the guests, but considering whether you actually should be consolidating some of those VMs. Have you ended up with a bit of virtual service sprawl because it was so easy, and can things kind of be consolidated and run the same services that are currently on different machines onto one machine? Do you in fact need some of those machines? If you can kind of work out how to decommission some of those guests in your environment, maybe that's time better spent than, you know, bringing it across onto Hyper-V. And then the other thing you need to be considering when you're kind of planning out the migration of the workloads is what kind of downtime those workloads can tolerate. Because there will be some download in pretty much every situation with every kind of tool to bring machines across. So you need to understand what kind of downtime they can tolerate, and also understand the dependencies between machines. If an application has three tiers, then you might be really wanting to consider migrating all of the servers that form part of the application at the same time in the same downtime. But of course, it's not always that simple either, because some of those tiers, like a SQL database, might in fact be serving some other applications, and you kind of get a spider effect. So you need to map out those dependencies. And through this, you'll determine that some machines can stay and some will actually be rebuilt in a new OS, and I've just got to bring the data over, and some machines are actually going to migrate across. To help you kind of with that planning, if you don't have a config manager tool like Config Manager, then, you know, map. Everyone probably knows about MAP. It's been around for a long time now. Kind of started with the desktop focus, moved into server focus ages ago as well. So it's a tool that'll scan your network, help you inventory what you have, and start to apply some assessment to that and give you some, you know, idea about whether those workloads will actually run on Hyper-V or not. Will you still need to get out your own spreadsheet and kind of work out your own mapping and dependencies and which machine's going to come across and everything? Yeah, you will. You know, you can't just use a tool like Config Manager or a map alone. You're still just going to have to create your own kind of, you know, running set list or something about what's going to be migrated when. But that's available to help. So, like I said at the beginning, we don't really think that the identify and map, you know, step is something you do, completely finish and then move on to migrate. It's something you do a bit of, migrate some, do a bit more planning, migrate some. And remember as well that when you're planning for those migrations, you're going to be lodging change requests and maybe testing and all that kind of stuff. So things have got a lead time as well from when you work out what you're going to do and when you're going to do it, get approval for that, and come back and do it later on, and in the meantime you're working on other things. So it has to be a bit of a cycle between identify and migrate. But when we're actually doing the migrate, you know, we said that at the beginning there was kind of two main ways of thinking about migrating, and I've switched these here so don't get too confused, but the first one was to replace what you have with a new shiny one, so maybe a new OS built on Hyper-V, and then just move the contents. And the other way was to pick up the virtual machine and, you know, do some kind of conversion on it and relocate it onto Hyper-V. So with the replace scenario, you know, we're talking about this idea that you're picking up the contents and you're moving it over into a new house, into a new server. But unlike moving, you know, house, where a house can only exist in one place, I'm a bit confused there. So unlike, you know, moving to a new house alone, you are having to build the new house as well. I guess that's the important thing to bear in mind there. So the house has to be newly built, and you're deciding there, am I building it kind of in the old style? So am I taking the 2003, 2008 OSs? Or, as I've suggested a few times, you're probably thinking about upgrading that OS. But then you do need to think about application compatibility. Will the things that were running there on your old one, are they going to work on a newer OS version? So consider all that. With the convert and replace scenario, it's we are picking up the machine and we're taking it from old hypervisor to new hypervisor, but we don't, unlike the physical world where we have to pick this house up and move it across, it is virtual, so we've got this little advantage that we can kind of duplicate things. It can stay where it was for a while, we can duplicate it, perform some actions on it, and then kind of choose when we cut over. So that's good theory, but what are the actual tools that we can use to do that duplication and relocation? So the first one is VMM. VMM has some functions in it to when you're using it to manage VMware and Hyper-V, where you can just pick up a guest and drag it from one hypervisor to another. Now that sounds pretty awesome, but it doesn't really work so awesomely. I'll run through the wizard. You know, all wizard-driven. You click, the server that you're going to migrate, the new hardware profile once it is migrated, choose the host that you're migrating to, and confirm that the network configuration is right or remap the networks. And then you kind of get to the end. You can click on the view script button and see the PowerShell. So then you go and do whatever funky things you want with that PowerShell yourself. The problem with VMM to use for the actual migration is that we found it to be slow, like up to 10 times slower than the next tool, Microsoft tool I'm about to show you. And also it's got a couple other limitations. The VMware tools need to be removed from the old guest before you move it, but this migration process doesn't remove them for you. So you actually have to jump into the guest, remove VMware tools, and then shut down the guest and then initiate the migration process with VMM. It will install the Hyper-V integration services for you at the end, but you need to do the removal of VMware tools. And so that, plus it's slow, probably not really the recommended tool. Instead, MVMC, the Microsoft Virtual Machine Converter. Now, this is a standalone tool that's free to download and it is supported. And it operates in a kind of a similar style. It's all GUI-based and you pick your host, you pick your guest, you pick the host that you're moving it to, and you let it run through. But this one actually will remove the VMware tools for you automatically. So with this one, you start the process while the source machine is turned on. You let it connect to it, remove the VMware tools. It shuts it down. It does a clone and conversion of the hard drive, and then it creates it in Hyper-V, and then you can choose what you want to happen after that, which one gets turned on and which one gets stays off. We'll talk more about that shortly. It does install the integration services at the end on the new machine as well. So let's just step through a little bit about how it works. From the MVMC machine, you pick your VMware source host, and then you pick the VM source guest. And you also pick your destination Hyper-V host, right? And then you say go. And what it does is it snapshots the guest. It will then go and uninstall the VMware tools and shut down the guest. And then over the network, copies the VMDK hard disks over the network onto the VMC machine, the MVMC machine. From there, it actually runs a process where it will duplicate whilst converting the format of that hard drive from VMDK to VHD. When it's finished, it will copy the VHD file over the network onto the destination Hyper-V server, and then it will create a Hyper-V guest and associate those VHD hard disks with it. And then from there, it will turn on one or both or whatever you want of either the original source or the destination copy. The supported configurations of this tool is that it will convert and relocate guest OSs of Server 2003 SP2 and above, Server 2008, and Server 2008 R2. It doesn't yet support a guest OS of Server 2012. It does run, so the actual tool that you download and install, you can install that onto a Windows 7 machine or a Server 2008 R2 or Server 2012. So that's where you're running the actual migration tool from. The source VMware hypervisors that it supports is 4.1, 5.0, and actually 5.1 as well. And the destination hypervisor that it supports is Server 2012 and Server 2008 R2. But, you know, we're probably talking about 2012 here. A couple of things to note there. The source disks, the virtual disks that it converts have to be SCSI, not IDE. This is of the guests. But it does support both thin and thick provisioned virtual disks. And the destination in Hyper-V can also be fixed or dynamic, so thin or thick disks. Although there's a little gotcha with that that we'll cover later. So Timothy's going to show us MVMC in action and show us how to use it to kick off the conversion of a machine from VMware to Hyper-V.
Cool, okay. So I'm just running MVMC from the VMM server. As Michael mentioned, you can install it anywhere. Just go next. Okay, so once again, we put in our vCenter FQDN. I'm going to use my domain admin account here. So this is going to connect to vCenter and just enumerate a list of virtual machines that vCenter server is managing. We'll see that it's got the name column here, which is just what you see in VMware, but it also has the DNS name column. So this is just because it uses WMI, and so the guest needs to be running. It needs to have VMware tools enabled, and you also need to have WMI enabled through the firewall for this tool to work. So you can see that we've got a mix here of candidates that we can use and candidates that we can't convert. The one that I'd like to convert is called Web2. It's thinly provisioned, so we can see that in the VMware data store, it's using almost 11.5 gigabytes, although I think that the actual VMDK has been provisioned with, I think it's 40 gigabytes of storage. And we have some little exclamation marks here or little blue icons just indicating these are guys that we can't actually convert. So this one's off, they're all off. If you've got templates, you can't convert those and so on. So go next. Okay, so this is where you can pick the state of the source machine, so in VMware, and the state of the destination machine, so in Hyper-V. So logically, you might be thinking, well, if I'm converting it, I want the VMware one to be off and the Hyper-V one to be on. But actually, there's a couple of things to consider here. First and foremost, regardless of when you decide to actually turn your converted Hyper-V guest on, while it has installed integration services for you, it requires a further reboot. So it's not just a matter of turning it on and like everything's good. There's just like a couple of extra things you got to do, reboot it, and then also connect it to the virtual switches in Hyper-V. So just watch out for that one. Also, if you've got a machine that maybe it doesn't have data in it, maybe all its data in that application is stored in a database server or somewhere else, maybe you can convert it like, you know, today and then actually do the cutover at some future time, especially if you need control over that. So for this one, I'm just going to keep the source on and the destination off because I want to validate the end result. Go next. So from wherever we've installed MVMC, we need a local path to download our VMDK file, convert it into VHD, and then upload it to our Hyper-V server, which we pick in the next screen. So I mentioned before that I'm using a thinly provisioned machine, and it's currently taking up, let's call it 11.5 gigabytes. So you might be thinking that it's going to download 11.5 gigabytes, and it's then going to convert that into a VHD file, also of 11.5 gigabytes. However, you would be wrong. It's actually going to be downloading that 11.5, but the caveat here is that in this tool, even if we go dynamically expanding, it's going to expand to the full 40 gig size. Now, you don't actually have that 40 gig of data in the VHD. So you can run the compact tool after, and it will just shrink right back down to 11.5. But there's just another gotcha there. So be aware of that as well, and make sure you allow additional time when you're planning that. It also means that you need additional space on your MVMC server, because you need the 11.5 to download and the 40 to convert into. So it's not 20, it's, yeah, like more, 50. Okay, I've got to pick a UNC path here. I just created a shared folder called converted VHDs, and away we go. So it's just going to validate all that. And then we can go, oh, there's a little warning up here about just the video memory. So in Hyper-V, it's 4 meg, and in VMware, it's 8. That's fine. The machine will be fine with that. Just hit finish. And now it's actually going to start doing it. Now, this process takes about 40 to 50 minutes. We don't have that much time left. So did you bring your time machine or no? Okay.
All right. So so we won't see that finish, but you know, it converts it through, puts it on Hyper-V, and then in this case, it wouldn't turn it on because we said don't turn it on, and we can jump in and validate that things are okay, give it the reboot. So that's good because it does the actual conversion, right? Like when you've decided, I'm not going to build a new server and just move the contents myself. Instead, I'm going to take the server that I've already got, the guest, and do an actual conversion into a new file format for the disk and stick it into Hyper-V. And that's good. That's all kind of handled for you by that tool. But Timothy alluded to, you know, the fact that there's a little bit that you have to do afterwards. And, you know, the fact that you've got to do that little bit afterwards, and the fact that it takes some time to do the conversion, and while that conversion's happening, your source probably needs to be turned off. You know, these are serious implications for you in the real world when you're actually doing migrations, right? So I don't have a wonderful answer for you, so don't wait for me to say this, but I do have some specific things for you to think about, for you to help kind of make a really achievable migration plan. So you need to think, the source that you're migrating, is it containing stateful data? If I take a snapshot of it or a copy of it today, but I don't actually put that copy in production until 3 days' time, is that okay? And for a lot of workloads, it is, because they're running services, but they don't actually hold that data source, right? So a web server that's just reading its config and everything from a SQL database or something might be fine. And so you can take a snapshot today, do your conversion, you know, overnight, whatever, come in the next day or two, check that it's all okay, give it the reboot for the integration services to fully apply, make sure the networking config's right, possibly even put it onto an isolated network to do a bit of a test, if you like, but and then decide, right, I'm actually cutting over. And there's other options with that kind of approach as well. When you're cutting over machines, you might be able to, if they're sitting behind some kind of load balancer, then you can stick a new machine into the mix behind the load balancer and then use that abstraction layer to help you coordinate the cutover as well. Like if you've got a NetScaler or something like that, maybe if you've got a Citrix implementation, you might be running NetScaler and you don't even know that you've got a load balancer there that you can use. Or possibly you don't have that, but you might be licensed for it. So think about alternate ways of helping with that cutover. But you know, you're thinking about, is this application stateful? If it's stateful, it kind of gets harder, right? I spoke about non-stateful data, like a web server that you can take a snapshot today and cut over tomorrow. But if it's stateful data, that you can't just say, I'll clone it today, and then let people use it and all the data changes, and then when I cut over, I'm rolling back effectively a few days. That's not okay, obviously. So what is okay with that? Well, maybe if a longer period of downtime where you actually take the copy of it, do the conversion, ship it over onto the Hyper-V server, and then you bring it up, reboot it for the integration services, make sure the network's right, and then go, cool, now it's cut over. That one's up. My source has stayed off the whole time during that process, and I've effectively migrated that over. But your downtime for that service was the whole time that it took to do the export of the VMDK, the conversion to a VHD, the copying over to the network to the Hyper-V server, and then it relied on you probably being there to make sure that you turn it on, check integration services are working, check the network's right, and then kind of give it the all clear and stick it onto the network and go, yeah. And probably that needs to be out of hours, and how long is that going to take? And so it kind of can get a bit difficult for that kind of server. So an option that you have is to say, for those kinds of things, maybe actually creating a new guest and just getting the contents migrated over is a better option, because you can pre-migrate a lot of those content over. So if it's a file server, for example, serving data, you can robocopy all the data and the permissions and the shares and all that kind of stuff over onto your copy of the server, and do that every night to kind of keep it delta up to date. And when you're actually doing the cutover, you take the original offline to users, do one more final copy, and then bring the new one back online. And then your downtime's much quicker, and you've actually achieved that by not doing a lift and convert and move, but by doing a replace. The other thing too, so that's cutover. So the other thing there is some third-party tools around as well that can help with that. And DoubleTake in particular is one I want to call out. That process I just spoke about, making a new server and then possibly taking the data across from the old one to the new one and then doing the delta and sharing it out. That was just with RoboCopy, for example, as the migration as the tool that copies the data. But DoubleTake Move is a product that will actually sit an agent into the source guest, and it will replicate the contents of that to a destination another destination guest on Hyper-V side, and any kind of config, it actually copies it clones the machine. And it will be able to pre-copy all of the machine, not just the file data or whatever. It just copies the whole machine. And when you when you're preparing or you're close to the cutover, you can tell it, okay, I'm close now, and it will make sure it kind of keeps it in lockstep. And then you say, do my actual cutover. It turns off the original source. It will do one final copy of the data, and then it will turn on the destination, and it will be an exact duplicate, and the downtime is really only the time that the servers take to shut down and come back up. So it's another option. It is a paid-for tool, though, so you have to pay per guest that you migrate with that. It's not particularly expensive, and for those kinds of workloads where it's really difficult, you can't. It's got stateful data, you can't afford the downtime, it is a really good option there. You might not need to use it for everything. You possibly could, but obviously it's got a fee per VM, where the Microsoft tools are free and would cover 90% of your other workloads. So that's all good. You understand the Microsoft tool for doing the migration. You've got to take it offline, take a copy of the VMDK, convert it, copy it over to Hyper-V, turn it on, do a little bit of config. But I've got a lot of VMs. So how do we do this at scale? And I guess that's where we kind of move into what we think is the fourth step in this, where you're looking at optimizing and automating not only the original process of migrating, but other functions. And we'll talk about the other functions soon, but let's talk about migrating optimizing the actual migration process. So we've mentioned MVMC, and Timothy showed us the GUI of that. And it is a GUI, it's standalone, you do one at a time. But behind the scenes with MVMC is an exe that you can just call from the command line. And so you can call that exe to do the actual heavy lifting by anything you like, batch files or PowerShell scripts or whatever. And Microsoft have written a set of PowerShell scripts that are made exactly for this purpose. And so they're a framework of scripts that help kind of orchestrate and automate that process, and they just call on the exe, the MVMC exe, to do the actual migration conversion. It's extensible and flexible. It's reasonably easy to kind of get up and running, but then again, it is PowerShell scripts, and it's not an actual supported product. It's one of those things that kind of gets developed on the side and gets up on blogs and and it's there. So you can use it, you can contribute to it, you can feed back to the project. And it is a really good way of kind of starting to add a bit more automation and process around it. There's another option that you have. If you have Orchestrator, or if you don't have Orchestrator, you could install it since you'll be licensed for it because you've got VMM. And really, this is what Orchestrator is made for. This process of coordinating and orchestrating and dealing with error conditions and then writing to log files. And I guess we see this as probably, well, A, it's a product that's supported by Microsoft. B, it's kind of got a really nice GUI interface so you can see the flow of what's happening. And it might be a bit easier to integrate into some of your other systems in your environment, like help desk tools or change management tools, possibly, you know, into SCOM and put machines in maintenance mode before you're migrating them and all those kinds of things. So a lot of power and flexibility in Orchestrator so that you can look at a large-scale migration process. But again, it comes back to, well, why? What are you doing right now in this project for migrating to Hyper-V? What kind of size environment are you looking to achieve the migration for right now? And you're not going to, you know, jump in and start there. You're going to jump in and start on some of those kind of more manual and simpler processes, running MVMC through the GUI first, getting comfortable with it. So that's the migration automation. What about once everything's on Hyper-V, what else can you start looking at to optimize? And the one that we mentioned along the way here was bare metal provisioning. So, you know, how are you going to be building your Hyper-V hosts, both the initial hosts while you're doing your migration and maybe also ongoing builds when you're buying new hardware? And so VMM has that bare metal provisioning built in, so we encourage you to kind of go and look at that as a next step. And then I guess overall you've got this new virtualization environment. Maybe this is a good opportunity to start thinking about some of the other things in your environment that manages that. So is it a good time to reconsider the monitoring tools you're using? Are the monitoring tools you're using now VM aware? Possibly might want to look at putting SCOM in. The backups, how you're doing backups, that's something you have to consider through this whole process. If your backup products are very VM aware and integrated into VMware, then you'll need to consider what you do in the Hyper-V world. Does the vendor you use already have a product? Do you need to switch products? Or maybe if you weren't really taking advantage of the fact that your workloads were virtualized and you were still running inside guest backup products, this could possibly be a time to evaluate the market and look at changing your backup products and regime. And I suppose you also need to think about ongoing guest provisioning. You had your processes for provisioning new guests in VMware, so you have to adjust those at least somewhat in Hyper-V. And you need to create, at a minimum, some new templates in Hyper-V. But we want to encourage you to think about using some more of the functions that the System Center family provides to kind of take your guest provisioning up a level than basic templating and start to think about actually using service templates in VMM rather than just VM templates, so that when you're provisioning workloads and guests, you're not just provisioning like the OS level and then leaving the app, you know, layer to someone else to come and manually configure, but you're automating some of those common app layers as well. And the more and more you do of those, the closer you get to being able to actually provide self-service capability to business units or even, you know, other people in IT, which ultimately gets you being able to provide a private cloud to your business. Yeah. I don't think we've got time, do we? I think we're over.
Yeah, I think we're a little bit over.
Or do you want to? We're just on. We said 2:40.
It's
2:40. Let's do it quickly.
Okay.
All right. Timothy's just going to show us a really quick demo of App Controller for providing self-service to a non-IT user for a new provision of a virtual machine guest on Hyper-V.
Okay. So I've got a user here, Joe Bloggs. Just going to log into App Controller here. So App Controller is just a Silverlight-based website. It's pretty lightweight, and it gives us some self-service capability to tie into Virtual Machine Manager. So I've created a cloud here which has some limits. We can create as many virtual machines as we like as long as we don't use any more than 10 processors, 300 gig of storage, and 24 gigabytes of memory.
And that's just what that user's been allocated?
That's for the cloud, but we could also restrict this per user as well. Yep. So got a cloud here called the Finance Cloud, inspirational, and we'll go deploy. So I've created a service template for the Finance app. And if we go configure here, I'm just going to give it another great name. Okay. So we can see here that the Finance app has got a database tier and a web server tier. So two virtual machines. If we weren't using a service template, we would need to provision one, configure that, provision another one, configure that, and away we go. So because we're using a service template, we can do both at the same time, hopefully. So that's what it looks like to Joe Blogs. What does it look like for us, the administrators? So back in VMM here, we have the jobs view. I'll just see if I can make that a little bit bigger. And we can just see, like, away it goes. It's doing both virtual machines, and it's going to do a lot more customization than we could have done. So service templates are great because they allow you to configure Windows roles. You can precede them with data. You can get scripts in there. You can do a whole lot of really cool stuff beyond just creating a new machine and joining it to the domain, which is more or less what most templates will give you. Under VMs and services, we're in the VM view mode here, so we can see a couple of new virtual machines have popped up. We also have a services button up here. Here we go. The one I tried to create early didn't go so well. Okay, and this is the one that we're deploying right now. So once this is deployed, it's actually really easy to scale this out. So if we decided that maybe we're using SCOM or something else to sort of figure out how much load this thing is under, we can just add another web server pretty easily. And that's pretty much it. These are some great reasons to adopt self-service and App Controller.
Yeah, and I guess that's something that we want to challenge everyone on a little bit as well and go, you know, there's some really good reasons for moving to Hyper-V. There's some compelling cost arguments. There's the fact that it's a single vendor and all that kind of thing. But really, the vision here is that you start to use a more integrated management stack to provide a higher level service to the users and the stakeholders of your IT environment. And it's not just about, oh yeah, it's another virtualization platform. It's really more about actually taking advantage of the system center stack. Now, along the way here, we've mentioned a few little tips and tricks and gotchas. I just want to recap a couple of those and also add a couple of ones that we didn't manage to slot in. We haven't spoken about raw device mapping in your VMware guests source. I said that the source needs to be a SCSI disk, a virtual SCSI disk, and that's true. None of the tools that we've shown there really migrate or deal with a raw device mapping. So you still need to cater for that in some other way. You could look at whether you can just reattach that LUN to your Hyper-V destination, or you might be looking at actually copying the contents of those LUNs over onto a new copy of a server. So if you're going for that kind of move the furniture, then you know the furniture is the contents of the raw device mapping file. Also consider whether you really need to be using the RDMs anymore as well. Some of the reasons that people kind of did that in the earlier days don't necessarily hold true. The perceptions around performance of that aren't necessarily valid anymore, so you might be looking at moving that data from the RDMs into a VHD file as well. We've spoken about integration services, the fact that it needs to be there. Pretty much all the tools we've shown actually do install that, but the MVMC does need that extra reboot at the end to actually make sure that the integration services are working. You do need to remove VMware tools from your source before you start to copy the VMDK file and put it into the VHD. If you don't, then you're most likely going to get a blue screen while it's trying to boot. So definitely way easier if you just remove VMware tools while the source is running before you shut it down. If you're not sure that you're going to go ahead, just take a snapshot first, then remove the tools, and that way if you need to roll back, you just go back to the snapshot before the tools were removed. Bear in mind that when you're doing a conversion and relocation of a guest, when that guest comes up on Hyper-V, it's going, oh, I'm on new hardware. And depending on what that means for the application, it might and for the server, it just might cause you some problems. So be aware of that. If you're using GPU pass through on ESX, then you probably want to be using RemoteFX on Hyper-V. The dynamic VHD expansion. Timothy kind of mentioned that with MVMC. When you're saying that my destination disk on Hyper-V is going to be dynamic, and you think, cool, you know, the disk on VMware was 40 provisioned, but 11 used, logically speaking, if my destination is a dynamic disk, it's only going to be 11, but that tool actually makes it 40. And then you need to come along and run the compact over it to bring it back to 11. So think about, you know, that. It's a different disk, and it is going to take a different amount of space by default, and you've got to add that little step in. And then when I was saying that the hardware changes, things that are running on the machine might have a problem with that, like Windows license activation. And so the Windows server will actually need to reactivate itself. And so if you're using KMS, not a problem, but if you're using Mac, you might need to be thinking about how you deal with that reactivation and what that means for your license count online as well. And then one of the hardware changes was the MAC address changing. And, you know, in many cases it's not a problem because you've had static IPs on the network adapter, and we never really spoke about it, but all these tools deal with grabbing those IP addresses from the network adapters, storing them in memory, putting a new network adapter on, and then restoring those IP address details. Because as far as the guest is concerned, it's got a completely different type of network card. It's new hardware. So the conversion tools do deal with that. But if the way you were assigning static IPs to a network card was through something like DHCP reservations, well, the MAC address has changed. So, you know, consider that. And then also, if you've got third-party software running on the servers that is doing any kind of hardware checksum to see whether you've cloned the server, and it should go, hey, you know, this doesn't seem good, I'm not going to run, you're not licensed anymore. Well, you have cloned the server, and it probably should say, hey, this is not good, I'm not going to run anymore. So understand what those specialized software are that are doing those checks, and make sure that you cater for that and reactivate it before you actually cut over to those destination servers. Okay, so just a really quick summary. Migrate does not equal convert. You don't need to convert every workload on VMware to get it over to Hyper-V. You might not bring some over. You might consolidate. You might decommission. You might recreate. Take the opportunity to give your guest VMs a bit of love and get them up to a newer version of the server OS. And before you start out, know what you're trying to achieve. If the scope of what you're achieving is, yeah, I reckon I need to give this a bit of a crack, I'm pretty convinced, I want to see it for, you know, 2 hosts, 10 workloads, well, that's your scope. And keep your project contained to that, and don't set expectations that you're going to, you know, solve the problems of the world with this first one. Otherwise, you'll kind of get lost and you won't know how far to go, and do you think about changing the hardware, and do you buy new, you know, RDMA-enabled network cards, and blah, 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 blah. Keep it simple. Assign some storage from your existing storage and, you know, get 2 hosts running and put it on. If your scope of the project is for Hyper-V is actually to provide a new environment for some other new project, then, you know, focus on that and don't worry about future stuff just yet necessarily. And then, you know, once you know what you're doing, the four steps you want to be doing for every kind of project is building a Hyper-V environment with VMM, identifying what you've got, how you're going to bring them over, what will come, what won't come, what method you'll use, which tools you'll use, do the actual migration, kind of keep looping back around, identify and migrate, and then think about optimizing that, not just to automate the migration process itself, but to start to take advantage of the System Center stack around your new virtualization environment. All right, so some related content. Tomorrow at 3:30, there's upgrading your private cloud with Server 2012 R2. On Friday in the morning, building a fully automated cloud with System Center and Hyper-V. You know, both of those are Ben Armstrong sessions. And so Ben was on now. Again, thank you for coming to this one. If you're kind of regretting that, then you can actually watch his, and I recommend that you do anyway, on demand afterwards. That's that last one, What's New in Server 2012 R2 for Hyper-V. So that's it. Thanks very much. Thank you. So we might just take a few questions if anyone has some. There's one eager guy there. So the question was, is it possible to migrate ESXi environment without a vCenter server?
Comes down to how much downtime you're willing to accept. Then, yes.
Because in your demo, you couldn't add the host with no virtual center existing.
Yes. But that's okay, because if you're going to use the MVMC tool, that doesn't require VMM. So you can actually point that directly at an ESXi host, directly to a Hyper-V host.
Yeah, so it's something we didn't mention. If you use VMM, you're going to need vCenter. But if you're using MVMC, you can say point it directly at the host and do the migration.
Can you manage and migrate? So obviously you can migrate, but you can't manage.
Correct. So the follow-on question is, can you manage and migrate ESXi? You can migrate, but you can't manage it without vCenter. You can't manage it with VMM without vCenter. Yeah,
cool.
Yep, up the back. Oh, did you say NetApp Shift?
Yeah,
actually, I meant to mention NetApp Shift. Yeah, it's an interesting project that NetApp's got. I think it's still in beta. So they're actually, if you've got a NetApp SAN, then you can actually run a tool from them that will do the actual VMDK to VHD conversion, but it does it very quickly without actually cloning the disk. And so essentially the time delay of taking a copy of the VMDK file, converting it to VHD, and then copying it across the network is removed. Your Hyper-V machines use this, you know, we'll just see the VHD there, and it will look like it's in VHD format. Exactly how they do the conversion so quickly, I'm not sure, but it's really quick. The only thing is that that Project Shift by NetApp, that tool set only deals with the conversion of VMDK to VHD. So it reduces that big delay, which is awesome, but it doesn't remove the VMware tools or create the guest or configure it and install integration services and make sure it's on the right network and turn it on. But there is support in MAT, the Microsoft Virtual Machine Converter Automation Toolkit, that will use Project Shift, and so it orchestrates the other bits around it, you know, the removal of the VMware tools, installation of integration services and what have you. So the tool by itself doesn't handle it, but the other Microsoft stuff around it does. Yeah.
What are people doing about hardware? That's a safe example. You've got your environment, you've got your service, your storage, and you know, you don't have
Yeah. Yeah, so the question was, what happens if you're trying to do this migration and you don't have a whole, you know, duplication of your hardware to migrate to? Really, essentially, like if you really want to try to get a little bit of headroom. So a couple of more machines at least, but really it's just a shuffle. So if you're trying to identify, you know, enough that you can move off, if you've got somewhere to move them, the first few to, and then after you move them, take some of your hosts from VMware, reinstall them as Hyper-V, and then they're new available ones that you move over. It's sometimes a bit harder. Well, I mean, you know, it's the same kind of thing. It's all about how much headroom you've got. So storage can be the same kind of shuffle problem, but sometimes possibly depending on how you've managed your SAN in the past and how you've carved it up, you might not so easily recoup those machines to repurpose, or the storage to repurpose. Sorry, I couldn't quite hear that. Yeah, and I guess you wouldn't go and buy a whole bunch of new hardware just for the migration, but if you can just get enough to move some workloads off to free up a host so that that one could be repurposed and just do that shuffle around. The other thing, I guess, on the storage note, like if you've, you know, the NetApp stuff wouldn't necessarily mean that you need to duplicate your storage. But at the moment, there's not really any way around that. You do need to get a machine from somewhere to run Hyper-V on it. And when you initially have Hyper-V on it, it's not running any workloads. I guess what you could possibly look at doing is do some, if you're going to decommission any guests, maybe do that first, and that might free up enough capacity to get you started. Yeah.
You could also look at something like infrastructure as a service in Azure or AWS, maybe even as a temporary thing.
Yeah, true. Yep. And the other thing, I guess, if it's a storage problem, you know, something like putting in a new bit of storage just to initially help you out of the bind with capacity. You know, Nimble has some high performance, really cheap kit that you could pop in and then use that for temporary space initially, and then look at seeing if you can move. Yeah, well, I mean, it all depends, I guess, on the size of the environment. It's not out of the question to temporarily use some direct attached storage as well, just to kind of help get you out of your bind initially until you free up the space. Yeah. All right, thanks, guys. If you've got any more questions, we're out of time, so just come down and we'll be happy to answer if you can. Thank you.
Thanks.